Good evening. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lynn Curtis. I am co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum, and I'm also the curator of exhibitions. I'm your chair for today's program. Tonight, we have Susan Weiss, who will be speaking, and I'm going to turn the program right over to her. She is, for those of you who don't know her, is a working artist in both painting and photography. She received a BA degree from the University of Michigan, an MA from Mills College, and an MFA from San Francisco Art Institute. Her work has been shown in San Francisco and throughout the U.S. The project, Service Unquestioned, was photographed in Georgia at Fort Stewart and at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C. It's now my pleasure to introduce Susan Weiss.
So thank you, everybody, for coming, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank. There's so many people to thank for this project, but first of all, Lynn Curtis, for allowing me to have the show, all the families, the soldiers who participated in the project, and General Jeffrey Phillips, who came out from Washington and is here and is going to be part of the program tonight. And without his support and encouragement, this would have never gotten accomplished. So thank you so much. So what happened was in 2009, my husband John and I were living in Georgia, just outside of Savannah in a town called Richmond Hill, and about 24 miles down the road is a very large Army base called Fort Stewart with a satellite base right in Savannah called Hunter Army Base. And I was asked in the spring of 2009 to do some social programming for the community that we were living in, and I knew that there was going to be a major deployment taking place that fall in October of 2009. And I thought this would be an ideal opportunity to acknowledge what was happening, invite soldiers to our community to participate in some social activities and sports activities and whatever, and to give them a really nice send-off. And the reason was because we'd come back to San Francisco or we would travel, and you don't really understand what is going on because you're not really around an Army base or the military. You don't see soldiers in the supermarket or in a shopping center or in a parking lot. And people didn't really understand what was going on. And we, because we were so close, you know, we would see soldiers everywhere. And I thought this would be a wonderful opportunity to try and document as much as I could about what was going on. And I got the idea that we would do these social activities with the soldiers before they left. And we didn't know anyone at the base. I wrote a letter to the general. I Googled the base, actually, to see who the general was, and I wrote a letter and sent it to a general. And several months later, we got a response that, yes, we could do these social activities. And then I got the idea that we should also, that maybe I could photograph just the soldiers packing up. I thought that would be really interesting, seeing them loading their things. And that's how the project started. And through the assistance of General Phillips, who I will call Jeff, who's here, and I'd like to call him up and thank him. He is now a major general in the reserves. He is in Washington. At the time, he was a brigadier general, which is a one-star. For those of you who don't know, now he's a two-star general.
Now, brigadier general is BG or baby general. Major general is a major.
So what we're going to do is show how this took place. It played out over a year and a half while the soldiers were deployed, mostly to Iraq. There were some that went to Afghanistan, and how this project just evolved over the time period. So what I'm going to do is talk about what happened, show some slides. Jeff will have some comments, and then we'll progress through the years 2009, 2010, and then into early 2011. So I titled it Service Unquestioned because it's about the families, and the families are part of the whole process of the deployment, supporting the soldiers, and often they don't question, they just do, and that's how I came up with the title Service Unquestioned. So I started out taking pictures of the soldiers at the base, And actually, this is a shot when they were leaving, when they left to go to Iraq, actually, at Hunter Army Base in Savannah. But we'll step back to the first days when I started shooting in October 2009. And I just went there. I was assigned a person and started shooting pictures of the soldiers literally packing up their materials and goods for when they deployed. So we'll look at some of these photos.
For those of you who have heard the term hurry up and wait, this is the hurry up and wait part. You pack your bags, you're all tense, you're going over, and then we invariably wait for a truck to come, wait for a word to go. So this is that tense phase. You'll also notice that the soldiers have colorful patches on their left shoulder. In the Army, on our left shoulder, we wear the patch of the unit we're currently assigned to. And because when we wear a camouflage uniform, a combat uniform such as the ones here, it's what's called a subdued patch. It's normally monochromatic or just a couple of different colors. But for reasons of pageantry, we wore our full color patches as a matter of symbolism. So you'll see it looks a little... It looks a little discordant, if you will, with the camouflage, but it was our attempt to do a little symbolism work.
So these photos are all taken in the first few days when I was there. I was assigned to someone from the press pool who took me around, and this is actually when they were distributing the ammunition and the guns, which are behind that screen. And here's one. And at this point in time, I had not yet met any of the senior officers. I was just randomly shooting. In the final days, they sign all the paperwork before they board on the buses to go to the airplanes, and here they are just getting ready to sign all the paperwork. Then there's a final inspection. They go over their gear. They go over their dog tags. Everything is inspected. And we get ready for a picnic. The final event that they do socially is each small unit has a picnic or a farewell party or whatever, and this was a barbecue that I went to. The last official ceremony they have is called Casing of the Colors, when each unit has a flag representing their unit, their military badge, and they have a formal parade where the soldiers pass by, they roll up their flags, and they tie them up and store them while the unit is deployed. This soldier is Greg Geiske from the photo pool who took me around and was really the first soldier that I had contact with.
A note here, on his right shoulder you'll see the U.S. flag, which we all wear, and there's no other patch. In the Army, the tradition is when you've been in combat, you wear the patch of the unit you were in combat with. So a quick look at this soldier would suggest that he has not yet been in combat. Of course, a year later, he'll have the 3rd Infantry Division patch on that shoulder.
I just found this one interesting because it was his girlfriend's name tattooed in Hebrew on his neck, and I had to get that picture. So here we are at the formal parade in the parade stands. And this is the first time I actually saw General Phillips, who's on the far right, and I didn't know any of these people at the time. Next to him on his right is Ginger Kukulo, the wife of the commanding general, Tony Kukulo, who was already deployed. And that's her daughter next to her. Then there's Sergeant Major Ashman, who was the assistant to Jeff.
My Sergeant Major.
And other people who I didn't know. But I knew they were important, obviously, because they had the best seats in the stands. And I said, I got to get the pictures. So I'm still totally clueless about everything that's going on at this point. But there were some great pictures. And this is Colonel Sexton, Chuck Sexton, and Melody Sexton, and he was the brigade commander for his unit, which is about 3,000 soldiers, and he was overseeing his troops on the parade field as they wrap up the flags and get them ready for what we call the casing of the colors, and his wife, Melody, is at his side. And at this point, I had not really met them either. They are standing on what is the symbol of the Rock of the Marne, or the name of the base, which is at Fort Stewart, Rock of the Marne, and that's their insignia. And you can see it in the background on the parade field. And this, to me, this photo, actually, I love this photo because it sort of exemplifies the role of the wife, of the family, in supporting the soldiers when they deploy. And she is by his side supporting him and supporting all the other soldiers, as you'll see. And then the troops pass by and they review the troops. And those are all the flags that get wrapped up before they deploy. And then it comes time to leave. And 3,000 soldiers are deploying. It goes over a period of days of deployment because I think about approximately 300 soldiers leave at one time. And I went to several of the departures. And it starts at Fort Stewart, which is in this town called Richmond Hill, outside of Richmond Hill and Hinesville. And then they're transported by bus to Hunter Army Base, where the planes take off for Iraq. So everyone told me there would be a really difficult experience seeing the family say goodbye, and it really is. And it starts out in the afternoon, and they all start to gather, and they come. The soldiers come with their duffel bags and actually their guns, and they bring their families, and they try and make it as joyous as possible. But obviously, it becomes progressively more difficult as the day goes through and they get ready to board the buses.
Many of these soldiers are very young, 18, 19 years old. The average age of the American soldier in the current war is about 30. But these very young soldiers who are the privates first class, are in the 18, 19, 20-year range. And many of them are married. Our Army is more than 50% married now. So they are experiencing life for the first time as an adult. They are married, very young, and this is their first war. So all these firsts are occurring at once. This collision of emotional tumult is going on. The soldier's excited to be going over. The spouse, of course, is experiencing a wide range of very traumatic emotions. The soldier is as well. There may be children involved. So it's a real cauldron of emotionality that is occurring at this moment when the goodbye is said.
So this is a series of pictures of them saying goodbye, and it took place over several days and sometimes at night, so you'll see some of them that were shot in the evening. And some soldiers did not have families there, and they were just by themselves. This one was taken on Halloween because they deployed on the 31st, and this guy, his family showed up, and the little girl was in her Halloween costume, and you know, you had to take that photo. Some bring their dogs. This is Greg Geiske, the first soldier that I was with, his little baby. Another dog. So as the day wears on, the emotion starts coming to the surface. People get more tense. You can see it on their faces, and it becomes increasingly more difficult watching this. And the final thing that they do is they have a prayer service before they board the buses. And at this point, the families have already left, and the soldiers are there and about to board the buses to move to Hunter, where then they wait to board the airplanes. So at this point, I still didn't really know many people, and they kept saying, what other pictures would you like to take? I said, I'd like to take as many as possible. I had no idea where the direction of this project was going. I just knew I wanted to keep shooting, and I asked, could I go to the deployment day, actually, when they leave? And I was told, yes, I could. So I was there shooting, and then I said, well, can I go on the bus with the soldiers? And they said, yes. And I just followed them all the way through to Hunter. And by then it was nighttime. And then they move into an auditorium at Hunter, and they wait to board the planes. This was a young soldier, and she had these cookies in this tin, and her grandmother had made them for her as a farewell present. These two soldiers were giving each other manicures while they're waiting. This is a group of policemen who were actually mobilized to go over there because the mission was threefold. It was to provide training to the army and to the police force in Iraq. They were to assist with the elections in Iraq and just for general protection and maintenance in the country. So these were a group of actually policemen who came from around the country who were asked to participate and fly over and be part of the deployment. This is the oldest soldier in the group. He actually was in Vietnam. So you do the math. he's still doing it. And I took this shot. I was sitting at the floor at one point, and I saw these two soldiers, the one on the left with the cross, the one on the right with the gun, and I just thought it was a great contrast. And it turns out the soldier on the right is Colonel Sexton. At that point, I didn't even realize that. And they hang around for a couple hours till the planes are ready to depart. This is on another day. You know, one day I rode in the van with the soldiers, with the officers who were going over. And this is, that's in there twice. And it's just a sea of soldiers waiting to board the airplane. And then this is in the VIP room. That is Colonel Sexton on the right and his support staff. They had a special room where they could wait, and now they're getting ready to board the plane. And I was allowed to go on the airplane to shoot these pictures from the plane, looking back. And Jeff and I were talking the other day, or yesterday, we were saying that the youngest soldiers who hadn't been deployed before were actually quite excited to go over there and be part of the action. And as they got progressively older or multiple deployments, they're not quite as excited about going.
It's a cumulative effect of years, I think. When you're 20 years old, you're excited to go. When you're 30 years old, you're worried about your family. You're contemplative. You've perhaps lost friends in combat. This was my second war, and so you're not eager to go to war. You're eager to serve. You're eager to be with your soldiers, to bring them home alive. By the time you're 40, you have a family. This may be your second or third war. You're hoping that this one is worthwhile, that we're sending these men and women into service for something that's going to matter. So the years bring different emotions. But as we said goodbye to these soldiers, this is a very private first class young man. He's excited to go, like a fireman to fight a fire. And so this is an interesting paradox. We've been through now more than 10 years of war. Our enlistment rates in the Army are up. The services are doing well for enlistment. They're doing very well for re-enlistment. And yet we also say that our families are worn thin, frazzled, stretched. Older soldiers are experiencing challenges themselves. And a lot of it, I actually have done a lot of thought around it. And I attribute a lot of it to the sheer effects of youth. A very young person goes into situations like this where an older person is a little bit more thoughtful, having had the experience and understanding what lies ahead. So it's... It'll be good to see these wars end.
So Jeff's role in all of this is that he was actually the deputy commanding general at the base, at Fort Stewart and at Hunter Army, because the General Kukulo was deployed with the soldiers. And so Jeff was in charge of all the activities for the base, both at Fort Stewart and Hunter Army Base. And this is... on the plane.
You notice the most of the aircraft that they took over were contracted civilian aircraft.
So here is Jeff in his role as deputy commanding officer. And just to give you a background on Jeff so we can understand who he is, he's now a major general in the Army Reserve serving on the Army staff in the Pentagon. He's former deputy commanding general, as you see him in this role at Stewart and Hunter Army Base. He was in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, and where he served as public affairs officer for the 1st Cavalry Division. In 2004, Operation Iraqi Freedom, he served in Baghdad as deputy communication director and public affairs officer for the commanding general. And as a point of comparison, this is OIF 7, or Operation Iraqi Freedom 7. So He served in the Army as Deputy Chief of Public Affairs. He served in Germany, the Balkans, and he commanded an M1 tank company. He worked as a UN peacekeeper in Israel and Egypt and shared in the 1988 Nobel Peace Prize that was awarded that year. In civilian life, he served as Minority Communications Director for Disability Assistance and Memorial Affairs on the Committee on Veterans Affairs in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's been White House Liaison and Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs in the Department of Veterans Affairs. He has a graduate, he's a graduate of the Defense Information School, U.S. Army Command and General Staff College, U.S. Army War College. He has a BA degree in Journalistic Studies from the University of Massachusetts, an MA in Human Resource Development Leadership from the University of Texas, and a Master's in Strategic Studies for U.S. Army War College. He has won the Legion of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, 2 Meritorious Service Medals, and the Army Parachutes Badge, which I'd like to know more about.
You let gravity take over.
So, at this point, I had met Jeff, and the amazing thing about him is I called him the Renaissance General because he really cared and tried to help the families through all the various issues that come up with deployment. And on this particular photo, this is at a puppet show that he organized and arranged that was for small kids ages like 7 and younger to deal with the emotional aspects of a missing parent. And this was at one of the puppet shows. He's sitting on the floor with the popcorn, you know, laughing with all the kids. And that's one of the many activities that he did to make the life and living standards better for the soldiers while they were, the families while they were there. He also served in an official role representing the base. This is at the St. Patrick's Day Parade, which is a huge thing for Savannah. And you know he's the general because he's wearing the belt. Only the general gets to wear that big belt. And this was a parade that goes on every year in Savannah for St. Patrick's Day.
Actually, St. Patrick's Day in Savannah. Savannah has the second largest St. Patrick's Day parade in the nation. Behind, I guess, New York. New York or Boston, I can't remember which.
Yeah. So I got to walk the parade and photograph as the soldiers were in, as part of the larger parade. So back to October, the soldiers left, the last group left on Halloween, October 31st, 2009, and I thought my project would be over. That's as far as I thought I was going to go. And what happened was then November 9th, 2009, was the massacre at Fort Hood, and I thought for sure it would be over. They would never allow me on the base. And this is Melody Sexton, who was the wife of the colonel of the 2nd Brigade, and I kept in touch with her and asked if I could just come and see what they're doing, make some, do some photos, just continue with their project. And she invited me to this FRG meeting, Family Readiness Group, FRG, Family Readiness Group meeting, which is a structure that's in place for the families. And there's a hierarchy of reporting and command on the family and spouse side that begins with the general's wife. Then it goes down. The next layer is the colonel's wives, which she is, and then below that are the battalion wives, and then below that are the enlisted or and the soldiers' wives. And this is a meeting of one of these groups. Obviously, it was just before Christmas because the tree is up. And this is how they self-organize, and they control and monitor and help through all levels of the Army for the families. Technically, it's a volunteer job, but the higher level you are, your husband is or your wife is in the Army, or the more responsibility you have, with the burden of the responsibility really falling on this woman's shoulders. So that photo that I took earlier where she's standing with her husband became even more important to me because I realized the burden of responsibility that she had for these 3,000 soldiers and their families.
It really is extraordinary. The Army's about 14 or 15% female at this point. But overwhelmingly, the spouses are wives. I think we had a handful of husbands who were spouses, stayed behind spouses. So the Army depends on these spouses, overwhelmingly women, to organize with our help family readiness groups, which support each other, and perhaps most important, help the young spouses, going back to the young, primarily young wives, many of whom have, this is all new to them. They're struggling with this. They may have toddlers of their own, to help them. And the Army provides some resources, but they're volunteer. We try to give them health care, make sure they get some child care that's involved in there. We actually have a formal covenant that's a document. If you go on the web, you look at Army Family Covenant, there'll be a document that the Army leadership signed back in 2007. And the Army pledges certain levels of support to families. But the truth of the matter is we depend on the spouse's ability to do just what Melody was doing here. And this is going on all over the Army, and in fact, all over the Air Force and the Marines and the Navy as well. And this is the backbone of the Army. If this doesn't happen, the soldier is worried sick about the family. So this has to be taken care of.
So this is in a meeting of one of these groups. It's a Skype conference call with Iraq, and you can see the soldier on the screen. And actually, the soldier's wife is up in the upper right-hand corner. That's Anita, another woman that you'll see later on in the show. And they would frequently have these meetings, these Skype conference calls with Iraq. And just so you know, there's 10 hours time difference between Iraq and the East Coast. So the logistics in arranging these phone calls was also kind of cumbersome.
I think Anita was also, at that point, an Army Reserve Lieutenant Colonel.
That's right. And we'll get to that later, her story. So what happened is, as I got more involved, certain issues started coming up, and I saw, you know, the issues that you sort of read about or you heard about on television, I was actually witnessing, and I realized that I really needed to continue on this project and record what is actually happening here. So this is another conference call. The woman comes with her young baby. This is a reading to young children that Melody is doing, and what they would do is read stories to 5-year-olds and younger. This is Melody at the St. Patrick's Day parade on the bus, on the parade. And one of the things they organized is a walk to Iraq, which was to help organize the families, get them being physically active, and to honor their husbands. And the mileage difference, I have it down here somewhere, but they would try and walk the equivalent of the mileage distance between Savannah and Iraq, and by tracking their miles, and they had organized walks, and then you walk on your own or you exercise to try and get to the equivalent mileage. And this is at one of those walks. And it was organized by one of the wives. So that is Anita on the left at one of these walks. So this is Anita, and her wife was a brigade commander, and they are now stationed in Southern California at Fort Irwin. And in the hierarchy, she is below Melody, but she is responsible for all the soldiers in her husband's brigade, which totaled over 1,000 soldiers. So she is responsible for watching and taking care of those families. And here she is at a meeting that she organized, where she secretly went to the husbands who were deployed and said, "Will you write a letter, send it to me, and I will read them out loud to the wives." And this is what this is. And this is the wife hearing the letter read to her by her husband who's in Iraq. Here's Anita getting ready for their R&R. Everyone got R&R, and they happened to be going on a cruise, and she was getting everything ready for when her husband came back. She herself, as Jeff said, was in the reserves. She was in the reserve. She was promoted to colonel while she was in, and at her promotion ceremony, her husband is on the computer because they Skyped him. And this is the first deployment where technology had a major impact on the families and the communication with the families. And Jeff, I think, did the promotion. Didn't you do it?
I believe I did.
Yeah.
And it stuck because she stayed a colonel, I think, for at least a while.
For a while, right.
And I think she mustered out.
Well, you know, what happens is she was in the reserves, and you are still potentially deployable. So she was at risk for being deployed, and she retired so that she wouldn't be deployed. Yeah. And it was a very hard decision for her because she had been a career soldier. There she is. So as the time progressed, the story started evolving. This is Erica and her husband, John. And John is actually the driver for Anita's husband. And he, John came back when in time for Erica's delivery of their first child. This was his first deployment. And this was at the Savannah Airport. And you may ask, why are these people volunteering to have their photos taken? And it was all done voluntarily, but, you know, they wanted their stories told. They wanted to get the word out of what is actually going on with the families. This is when she's waiting for delivery in the hospital, both on their cell phones. This is right after the baby was born. He came out of the room and obviously was overwhelmed with emotion. And there's the baby. Baby's maybe 5 minutes old right there. So what happened is the baby was home. The baby was born. He was supposed to get promoted to sergeant on this home leave. And the baby the next day, after it went home, became very seriously ill and had to go back into ICU. And here they are in ICU. And what happens is Anita, who is the FRG leader for Erica, intervenes because the husband, John, is supposed to go back. His R&R is over, and he had to go back, and they couldn't leave because this baby was seriously ill. So Anita intervenes with her husband, and they get an extension, and the baby pulls through, and this is also in the hospital. And then he ultimately gets his promotion and goes back. And she's left with the baby. So this is another example of how the families rally, how this FRG system kicks in when you know, support all the soldiers and their families. And here they are at the airport saying goodbye. And you see the little baby. This is Dina. And Dina is another wife of a battalion commander. And this was their 7th deployment. They have 5 children. Her husband's 7th deployment. She, and this is taken at the St. Patrick's Day Parade. They are now in Hawaii, at the base in Hawaii. But she homeschooled because they were moving so much during this time period that she could not rely on school systems and moving the kids in and out of schools, that she would homeschool her children.
This was actually unprecedented. The Savannah Parade, as we alluded to, was huge. And there's always an Army contingent that marches in it. And this was, I think, the 2010 parade, and we decided that, Melody and company came to us and said, we want to have a spouses contingent march with the soldiers. We had like 1,000 soldiers, and most of the soldiers were Rangers who were stationed at Hunter, who were in between rotations, because most of our troops were over from the 3rd Infantry Division, which is that patch you've seen with the stripes. So we went to the to the parade authorities and said, look, we want to add a unit to a parade. Those of you who have ever been involved with the organization of a parade know that the parades are organized very carefully, and you don't just willy-nilly add stuff to a parade. So we said, well, we want to add an unknown number of family members. I can remember having the conversation to the parade. Well, how many? I don't know. It could be 10, could be 200. It's up to them. They're volunteers. They'll show up if they want to. And they allowed us to do it. And this was the first time we'd ever done it, and it was a smashing success. So, and Erica, the gal in the, I can't remember her first name.
Erica.
Yeah. She's wearing a red shirt with the crossed cannons of her husband's.
This is Dina.
Dina. She's the wife of an artillery officer, and you can just barely see the gold crossed cannons on her shirt. So she's representing his outfit.
Okay, so was it about this was in March, and that summer Jeff came actually up to Vermont, and because a lot of people wanted to see the work as in progress in Vermont, and we had a show, a presentation there, and it was at that show that it crystallized that they don't want to hear me talk. You want to hear the stories of the families. And when I went back to Georgia, I said to the women, to the families, I said, would you be willing to write an essay? And that's how we developed this notion of them writing about their experience. So if you look on the walls in this room, there are essays of them talking about their experiences during the whole year and a half of the deployment. So Dina kept her computer in her bedroom, and her husband would send her videos. He was involved with tanks and whatever, and she would play these videos in her bedroom. And these are some of her kids out on the street. So this is David and Kim, and in this case, Kim was the soldier. Well, they were both soldiers, and they had two sons, both autistic, and she was being deployed to Afghanistan. So David was able to negotiate where he would get out of the army so he would not be deployed, stay home with the kids while she went to Afghanistan. And they invited me over the night before she left, and she was packing up and getting ready, sewing on her name tags on her uniform. And I said to her, my God, you can do the cleaners can do this for you for a dollar. And she just, you know, I think obviously she needed to do something, and she's sewing all her name tags. So she takes me around her house, and it's loaded with stuff everywhere. And because she was a lieutenant colonel, she was allowed to take more stuff than other people. And she takes me into her garage, and she shows me a blue bucket. And she was going to a remote operating base in Afghanistan where there was no running water, no electricity. And she said, this is it. This bucket is my sink. It's my bathtub. It's my source of water. This is it. And we don't have that picture here, but I have lots of pictures of that blue bucket. And she lived there for a long time in this remote base. And periodically, I would get a postcard from her talking about her experience. And David, the husband, was home taking care of the kids. This is David at one of these FRG meetings because he became active in the group, because it's no longer Officers' Wives Clubs. It's called Family Readiness Group. So, great guy. And here he is in a skit with Anita in her uniform. Haircut with one of the boys. So one of the things he did, because both sons were autistic, is they came to him in Richmond Hill. They lived off base, and they asked him to start Special Olympics in the community. He did not want to do that because his kids, actually, their IQ was too high for Special Olympics, and they were too young to qualify for Special Olympics. So he said, I'll do something, but we won't call it Special Olympics. And he organized just a special athletic event for kids with special needs. And it's been going on for a couple years now in Richmond Hill. And there he is with his son. And this is when Kim came back. Most of the flights returned in the evening, late in the evening, and here they are reuniting on the field. And what the way they come back is they land again at Hunter, they're bused back to Fort Stewart, and there is a short ceremony, and they march across the field, and then someone says, okay, and everyone runs to each other. And that's what that is. And this is Kelly. And Kelly was pregnant, and she was having cesarean, and so they could schedule a Skype call with her husband right after the baby was born, and he could see the baby right away within the first 5 minutes. And she invited me over to take photographs of her in her house and then to the hospital. This was her third child, so she wasn't really uptight anymore about giving birth. And there's the baby right after it's born, and her other kids are looking through the window. That baby is about 5 minutes old there.
And these the hospital shots are most likely at the hospital there.
In Hinesville.
Okay, at Fort Stewart.
No, actually, because it was cesarean, she was in Hinesville.
Okay.
Yeah, because Fort Stewart did not do cesareans. So, this is where you see my obsession with medical issues, Bob. So, okay. And here she is with her son. I thought this was a very poignant picture, one of her oldest son. Just the weight of the pressure of what was going on. So what happened is she was supposed to Skype with her husband in the hospital, and it turns out there's a blackout, and a blackout is when a soldier dies and they cut out all communication, and she could not Skype with her husband, and she had to call Anita, who was her FRG leader, who arranged several days later for her to be able to Skype.
The reason they cut off communication is that the Army has a very organized procedure for notifying next of kin when a death occurs. And what has happened a few times in the past that we now fairly effectively seek to avoid is that one of the buddies of the soldier, meaning well, somehow communicates back to the family. Have you heard that John, so on and so forth? You can kind of see where this goes. And that's not the way we want to notify. It's very very special procedure that's been worked out to ensure that the family has the immediate support and has the right words given to them. Of course, at this moment, there probably are no right words. So that's why we do put, as you termed it, a blackout.
Right. Okay, so there she is with, you know, husband's on the computer. This is Robin. And as the time progressed, these stories started coming out. And then I heard about Robin, who has three children at that time. She now has five. And she said the only way, because of the time difference, the 10 hours difference, there was only a half hour in which she could get her kids to be able to speak and Skype with her husband. And that was happens to be right when she picked up her daughter from nursery school. She was in preschool. And I said, I got to see this, because she said she does it in her car. And I said, I got to photograph this. So she starts in her house, and there she's with the two younger kids, and her husband's on the computer, Skyping, and the younger kids are talking to the dad. Then she literally picks up the computer, her husband's on the computer, and she gets into her car, and the girl comes out of school, the little girl comes out of school, and starts talking to her dad on the computer. And this is how they communicated. And it was just wonderful. So in all, I think the computer was on for about an hour, this whole process, where she's talking with her husband, and the kids are able to communicate with the dad. And there he is. So on this particular day, she had brought home some school books, and she was showing them to her dad in the car. So Robin's daughter was turning five, and they said, what do you want to do for your birthday? And she said she wanted her dad to read her a story in school. And so they sent him a book, the book that the daughter wanted to read, and he's all set in Iraq, and to read this book to the class on Skype, and this is in the classroom. And what happened was, shortly thereafter, everything went out because there was another blackout, and he never got to read the book, and obviously the kids were all very disappointed, and then they went back a second time, they rescheduled it, and this is at the second reading. And there's the teacher, the kids in the class, and the father on the computer. This is Julie, and Julie was married to somebody, and during the R&R period, he came back and got off the plane and said, we're getting divorced. And divorce is a common problem everywhere, but, you know, there, you know, they, for whatever reason, it happens abruptly. And this was at her house when she was packing up. She moved back to Washington, and that's an old photo of her with her husband, and she's taking her photos off the wall, and she moved back to Washington. So I had the opportunity to go to Walter Reed three times, and the first time with General Kukulo, and then two other times. And this is on one of those visits, and I met Eli, who was in a IED and sniper attack, and his arm was in pretty bad shape, and that's his mother, was living with him in his small apartment at Walter Reed. And all of their stories are on the wall, and I encourage you, if you have time or come back, the show is up until July 26th, to read his, because it was a great story. So this is June 17th, 2010, and I had come down because there was a memorial. And what happens is, when a soldier dies, they do a memorial, they schedule it within 30 days. But on this particular case, one of the wives was 7.5, 8 months pregnant when her husband died, and the wife asked to postpone the memorial until after the baby was born. So they knew the scheduled date, and I flew down from Vermont to do this. And so this was the morning of that event. And on that day, there were actually five memorials, three from Melody's unit, two from another unit. But when I got down there, I also found out that there was another soldier a woman who came back because she was in a huge custody battle, and she disappeared with her children. And also there was a daughter of a soldier who had been found killed and abandoned in rural Georgia near the base. So these were the issues that Melody was dealing with on June 17th, 2010. And Jeff was supposed to come down from the memorial, and there was bad weather, and he did not make it. And this was a horrible day. Here she is talking with one of the soldiers going to the memorial.
The memorial, this is called Warrior's Walk at Fort Stewart. And these are all eastern redbud trees. Each one is planted for a soldier who dies. Suicide, combat, whatever cause, we make no distinction. And so the soldier's buried wherever the soldier's buried. But as quickly as we can, or we do them once a month. So normally the next month, the tree will be emplaced, and there will be a very dignified ceremony, a speech is made, the family is there, is cared for, and then the family gets to kind of consecrate the tree. Buddies put memorabilia around the tree, and the tree joins. There's now over 300 of these trees. Each tree denotes a soldier in this particular division of about 17,000 soldiers at any one given time who has given his or her life in service.
And you can see the young mother. She's holding the baby. And Anita was there, and actually her husband was home on R&R, and so he attended the memorial. And you can see how the patches are black and white because he's currently deployed. And this is at the end. It was overwhelming and hot, very hot.
Melly's a very special woman. Here she is with the weight, literally the weight of the world on her shoulders at the ripe old age of maybe, what, 38? I don't even know how old.
She's older than me.
Well, okay, I'll stay with 38. I want to remain friends with her. So, but when they were dating, I heard some of the stories about when Chuck and she were dating in Florida, and there was one story that sticks in my mind. She was driving his car somewhere in Florida, and it ran out of gas in an intersection, and she just left it in the middle of the intersection, locked up, and called him and said, "Come get your car," and she left. And so the car's locked up in the middle of an intersection in Florida, and he had to come and get it. And they got married, and they're probably the best couple I've ever known. But she has a real wacky side, and it probably keeps her going, frankly.
Yeah. And this is at the memorial, and this is not the funeral. This is a memorial, so it's in an office. It's very sterile looking. That's the young mother. This is a family of another soldier. That's the soldier. His brother's holding his photo. And this is Krislin. And I had heard about Krislin the entire year. Krislin, this was their second deployment. On her first deployment, she had one small child and was pregnant with her second. And she said it was so horrible. She was so angry at her husband. She did not want to have to go through that on this deployment. And she decided to take her two kids, who at the time were 5 and 7, and travel around the world. So they gave up their house. They took his stipend, his housing allowance, his salary, whatever he was getting, and she used that money plus military hops, and they literally went around the world for a year. And she took her kids out of school. She homeschooled. She Skyped. She blogged. And did all that. And this is right after she came back, and then she got new housing, and her husband was about to come back in a week or so. And it was an amazing experience for her. There's another woman. Depression was a huge issue for the women. Everyone went through it. What they would tend to do is just close down, close the drapes, lock the door, and have no communication for several days until they worked their way out of it. And they were pretty open about it, that they did it, but when they were going through it, they didn't want to talk to anybody. And this woman was pretty open about her depression as it was happening. And this is Audrey. This is the story of people caring for other people's children. This is the nephew of Audrey, and her brother and his wife were both being deployed. This was their son and he was 8 months when she first got him, and she came from Denver to take care of the son. She herself had her own health issues. She had had a heart transplant. She had had cancer. It was unbelievable, and she gave up her life to come to take care of this kid, because if she didn't, the kid was going to go into foster care. And so she literally raised this kid from 8 months on until the parents came back, and he was 18 months. And she obviously grew very fond of the child. He knew her as the mother. And this is the night when the parents were coming back. And she was very upset, obviously, because she was going to give up the child and then go back to Denver. And they're sitting there waiting on the field for the plane to land and the soldiers to come across. And this is when they first meet up again, the parents, Audrey, and the little boy.
Every soldier who has a child has to have a family care plan where they stipulate who's going to take care of the child if they deploy. If it's a set of parents, normally the spouse takes care, but if it's a single parent or both parents are military, they have to specify who's going to take care of the child. My belief is we would not deploy both parents if the child was not taken care of. I have never known a case where a child had to go into foster care because both parents. We did have a very interesting case that was explosive in nature. We had a young mother, had a 10-month-old son. She had designated her mother in Oakland to take care of the child. When her deployment neared, she decided that that wasn't going to work. Her mother expressed some concern. This was all in the media, by the way. And so the soldier decided, she actually missed the flight, which is a crime. In the military, it's a crime. And I was in charge of the outfit at that point. We had to decide what to do with the situation. And I remember going through that and thinking through my options as the commanding general were everything from convene a court-martial to just let the soldier go. And so I had to think through the whole range of my actions and what they would mean, not just to the soldier, but to the family, the child, to the unit. The unit's over there in Afghanistan, and they're looking back and they're saying, this soldier just decided not to come over. So what does that mean? So we discharged the soldier with the kind of a discharge where she didn't get all of her benefits, but she got some of them. She went back to Oakland with her mother, with the child, and the unit saw that there is some action taken, but we weren't harsh. Well, because those of us in leadership have been around and we've seen families and we understand what this can mean, especially to a young mother who this is her child. So these are some of the things that are going on throughout all of, and this happens all across the military as we go to war.
Yeah. So in the series of photos where she's reuniting with the family, you notice the mother never picks up the child. So it's very sad. This is General Kukulo. This was taken at Walter Reed. I went, like I said, the first of the three trips that I took, he was there. He was home on R&R, and at his last day of an R&R, he went up from Georgia to Washington to visit with soldiers from the unit. And he met with every single soldier that was from the base and others. This guy was just in the lobby and he started talking to him. And now we come to the end of the series and what I call celebration, because they start planning early on for when the soldiers return. And they have a series of balls and parties to welcome everybody back. Everyone gets ready. And then this is when they're returning. And this, again, I'm back at Hunter. The soldiers are coming back. And I was given permission to board the plane before the soldiers deplane. I don't know how that happened. And I'm on the plane, and I'm taking photos. But I was also taking photos on my iPhone and then sending them to the wives who are back at the other base waiting to see them. So I was doing both things, and they just loved that. And here they are, coming back, still on the plane. That's General Kukulo. And Jeff is greeting General Kukulo on the way back. When they reenter, the first thing, they turn in their guns, and then they see a video on reentry and how to behave and caution about driving and drinking and reentry into American life again.
Are you going to talk about this? What happens, the time off and all that stuff?
Yeah, no, you can.
So when they come back, there's a ceremony. They're reunited with their families, and they get a month off. They get 30 days off. And then they come back, and then we go through a very deliberate, basically, a return process where they go through health care, their records are looked at, but we give them time off quickly to get reunited with their families.
So he's interviewed by the press. This is on the bus ride back to the base. This is at the field. We sort of have to rush through because we're reaching the end. And the families are all there. These are some of the wives to greet them. That's Ginger on the right, another wife on the left. And this is a series of Ginger, and she sees her husband on the field, and she sort of breaks down. And then they finally get together. And like I said, they say, okay, and then everyone runs across the field to greet the soldiers when they come back. another family. This is Tanya Bianc. If any of you watch Army Wives on TV, she actually really is an Army wife and was stationed at this base, and that's her with her husband who was deployed. And then they go through a series of balls where they have the celebration, and at these balls they honor the lost soldiers. And then there's a lot of dancing and celebration. That's Melody and her husband. And some of the young wives, they're on very, very tight budgets. They can't afford ball gowns. They wear their wedding dresses. Here's an example of two young girls wearing their wedding dresses. And then they just really let loose. And that's the story. So it tells all the different aspects of what the families go through.
Thank you. I didn't want to interrupt, so I'm going to let it go over a little bit just for some questions. So I'll pass the mic around.
What do they end up taking with them in their packs? I'm just curious. What are they allowed to take?
Probably about half of the spouses live on base. They're allowed to live off base in an apartment or buy a house. We encourage them to live on base if possible because we can support them better. What we don't want to see, if we can avoid it, is for a spouse to go back to Detroit, because then we can lose contact with that spouse. If something happens, we can't reach out as readily to them, support them. But if they're living off base in the local area, I mean, it's easier for us to support them. But I'd say an estimate about half of them live on post housing. Our housing now is outsourced. It's actually run by civilian companies all over this country. So they build it, and a soldier gets a certain amount of money a month. Most of that money will then go to pay the civilian company that builds and manages that housing, very high-quality housing that we have now. Now, the second question was what they're allowed to bring. They bring, I think, four uniforms, all their combat gear, extra set of boots. They bring PT gear, physical training gear. You saw the gray T-shirts with Army on them, so that's workout gear, running shoes. They don't bring any civilian clothes, but they may bring some mementos from home and things like that. You know, you see teddy bears and you'd see things like that, pillows, you know. So, but it's all the gear they're going to need for a year. Now, once they get over there, they can get more gear. And so one of the notions was that soldiers had to ship over things, toothpaste, candy bars, what have you. They get all that over there. In Desert Storm, it was a different story. We were out in the middle of the desert, living in the desert. Now these soldiers are in fairly built-up areas where they have bases that they go to when they're not on patrol.
This is really a fabulous document of the lives of these families. Is this a general experience from your previous experiences? Does this represent the kind of thing that Army families and other service people in other areas go through?
This is 100% representative of what's going on right now.
Anyone else? No. Okay. I have one question. I know that you mentioned depression as being a particular problem, especially for the families left behind. But for the soldiers, that's another issue. Is that something you'd wish to talk about right now?
Depression has been a special problem for our Army. Everyone's read about the suicide issue, which isn't really getting much better. We have been struggling with it. We're not entirely sure how to fix it. The Army is probably right about at the level of the public, but doesn't mean that we accept it. It's difficult to say. It's the deployments. Many soldiers who take their own lives have never been deployed. So we're not sure what it is. But what we've done, and I will speak specifically for the Army, because I've been involved in the efforts to address depression and suicide. We've recognized that if a soldier, primarily a male, can't talk about what's going on with them, they can't get help. We can't help someone who doesn't communicate either verbally or non-verbally that there's an issue. So we have tried to remove the stigma associated with a mental health issue. And I personally have gone through depression. In fact, it was in 2008, so I was a one-star general in the Pentagon, and I was in depression. So I had to grapple with that. So what we try to do as an Army is say, okay, soldier, everyone has some cloudy weather from time to time. It's okay to ask for help. We will not think less of you. You are not less of a man. You are not less of a warrior. We will get you help. We can't promise that help will be efficacious, but we will get you help. We are also, so that's one thing that we've done, and we've gone to great efforts to do that. Videotapes, talks, making healthcare professionals available. We have doubled and trebled the number of healthcare professionals we have in the Army, and to the point where now we can't, there aren't any available to be hired. We have shortages because there aren't these people out there. They're literally not available. We've also, since about 2010, begun trying to build in what we call resiliency. Train people how to deal with the pressures, the separations, the deployments, the exigencies, all the things that occur during a deployment and indeed during military service. Some of these spouses had undergone 4 and 5 deployments. And in fact, it's much tougher on the family than it is on the soldier because the soldier's over there. Soldier knows what's going on. Soldier has his or her buddies, is busy. The spouse is at home with uncertainty, a feeling of helplessness in some cases. So we're also trying to build this resiliency, if you will, into the family. Is it fully effective? No. Is it partially effective? We think we're seeing some effectiveness. We've only been doing it for a couple of years. I am very proud of the Army because we're at least grappling with it. We don't deny it. I ultimately went to a good friend of mine who was an Army chaplain, and I talked to him about my depression, and he helped me work through it. And then I went to Fort Stewart about a year and a half, 2 years later, and all of a sudden I'm in charge of this unit with all these people in it, and we literally were coming on a suicide prevention week, and we had a ceremony and a speaker, and I just made the decision in an auditorium to tell 700 soldiers who were sitting there that their general went through depression and asked an Army chaplain for help and got it, and here he is. He didn't get fired, so if I can do it, you can do it. So our leadership is there are several generals in the Army who, Carter Ham, who's now a 4-star general, who has said, look, I've been through depression, and I asked for help. So can you. And the Army has said, thank you for that. So we're trying to do it up and down the spectrum.
Thank you so much. I'm afraid we have to bring this to a close. One more.
What happens when these men come back injured and they've been living on base? Do they then have to leave the base? And we've heard horrible stories about returning soldiers who have disabilities and can't get help. So I'm just wondering what happens when they come back.
What happens if they're injured or ill? Fort Stewart, as an example, has a tertiary hospital. So they're cared for there. And then there is a unit called a Warrior Training Battalion, which is staffed by soldiers who are not injured or ill or wounded. And these soldiers normally go to that unit, and they get, as important as healthcare is, healthcare management is just as important because there's tremendous amounts of different appointments you have to go through. You get lots of different drugs, and someone has to make sure you're taking all those drugs. So we provide a unit that these soldiers go to. They're still in a military environment. One of the worst things for a soldier is to get injured or wounded or become ill and then go to a hospital and just be on your own, just be a patient. These are young men and women who are used to being in a unit. They want to be in a unit. So we provide these units to kind of help them get organized, help their families. They get up in the morning. If they're able to do, they go for a run or they do some push-ups, they're still a soldier. And we manage all the administrative, sometimes the dizzying confusion of administrative stuff that's going on with a soldier. We're working out their VA benefits, their medication, their therapy, all these things are going on, and it is perhaps embarrassing. It took us a while to realize that this is too much for a young man or woman and a family to figure out on their own, so we created this. A lot of those horror stories you heard about, which were absolutely true, actually happened because we hadn't yet grappled with all this stuff. We're so focused on the fight, we hadn't focused on all these other things yet. We have now, and we've vastly improved. Are there still problems? Yes. At any one time, I'm always trying to help a soldier who comes to my attention. I get that soldier through the wickets, because the Army, the Marines Corps, the Navy, the Air Force, we are organizations full of human beings, and human beings are imperfect. So mistakes occur. And then our job as leaders is to fix the mistake and try to create a situation, improve the organization so it doesn't happen again. But yes, these things have happened.
Thank you so much. So I'll officially close, and I'd like to thank Susan Weiss and General Phillips again for such a wonderful program. And I get to bang the gavel, and the Commonwealth Club celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion is now adjourned.
And I want to thank Susan Weiss for caring enough to do this wonderful, wonderful thing.